With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public, free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom, and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Simon Angelo is the Chief Executive Officer and Publisher at Wealth Morning. He's been investing in the market since he was 17. He recently spent a couple of years working in the hedge fund industry in Europe. He's written a best-selling book and manages global share portfolios. Beat that. Simon Angelo of Wealth Morning, welcome back to our Money Talks here at RCR. Great to have you back.
Great to be here, Paul. Great to speak to your listeners.
Just been reading a piece that you've done recently. It's titled Bitcoin's New High, Fear, Greed, and Freedom. And I reckon it's a good time to talk about Bitcoin. And going through some of the points in your piece, I want to talk about some of them. I now understand that there's a cap on Bitcoin. I don't know how close they are to that. That the current price is over 70K. And I think it started when it launched at about 500 per Bitcoin, right? So keep that in mind. And also, it seems to be a very strong competitor to any future currency threatening the fiat currencies. And I wonder if it could trigger at some point that dreaded CBDC. So I want to talk about all those things. So Bitcoin, tell us about this cap, and they mine to the cap. Is that how it works?
Yeah, so the way Bitcoin was designed is there's a hard cap on it of 21 million to protect the integrity of the currency. So you can never have more than 21 million coins, and incentivized mining gradually brings us closer and closer to that. But yeah, my interest in it, we started to get some of our wholesale clients talking a bit more about it because last week the price took off like a scalded cat. Hit 73,000.
Wow.
And then it recoiled quite quickly, fell 12% over the past week. It's back down to, I think, about $64,000 this morning. Interesting thing for me is I work for the first regulated Bitcoin fund in the world in Jersey and the Channel Islands in 2016 when Bitcoin was $500.
Yeah, gee.
The thing with Bitcoin is the volatility. And when I was over there working with the fund, we returned 70% to investors in the first year. And I thought this is a great opportunity to go see some of the family offices on the island, because some of those guys are sitting on hundreds of millions of pounds.
Yeah.
And I remember I went to an office in St. Helier. It was an old European family shipping fortune from the 19th century, and they had some of the old antique furniture there from the boat.
So like the Oneiden line.
Yeah, wow.
Remember that program on TV?
I said, listen, guys, this fund's done 70%. This is a really exciting new digital currency, digital gold. And you know what they said? They said, well, we've got hundreds of millions of pounds under management. We don't care if you can make us 100 or 200%. We just don't want to lose any money.
Oh, that's interesting.
We're just quite happy to get 6 or 7 or 8%.
So when you're ultra, ultra rich, that sort of thinking starts to come into it.
Well, these guys are pretty experienced with risk. And here's the whole thing with Bitcoin. I mean, if you make a fortune on Bitcoin, well, you probably deserve it because you're accepting huge volatility and you're accepting risk of, well, almost potential total loss.
Yeah. Yeah, but what are the pressures driving it? Defy the pressure going the other way? Because it seems to me if gold goes up in value, Bitcoin goes up, doesn't it? The two would, the same thinking involved?
Interesting you say that. Gold is called a bid because a lot of central banks, including China, have been buying it. We did some work on Bitcoin and trying to figure out if it is actually uncorrelated with other assets.
Yeah.
And my colleague John did a graph. He put it alongside an ETF of risky, quite risky, highly leveraged tech stocks. So these are stocks you could win or lose on. And the graphs pretty much matched up.
Oh, okay.
So that tells me when you buy, if you look at something like Bitcoin, there's a lot of risk riding it. And in finance, we use something called the Sharpe ratio. That's how much volatility and risk you take on to make money. Now, if it's one, it's okay. If it's two, you're doing pretty well. Well, Bitcoin's just under one. So you're taking a lot of risk.
Is that now, though, or could you say, looking ahead, you can see that risk, those peaks of risks, risk versus reward, start to sort of flatten out a bit?
We look back since 2014, so this is all historic. And I should say, you know, past performance never guarantees the future. And, well, I'm on that note, everything we talk about today is not advice, just general commentary. Tick Got that it. Box.
Yep, tick it. Yep, ticked.
Now, your question as to what are the drivers going forward, I mean, I do notice as the US dollar gets weaker and that, you know, world's largest economy piles on more and more debt, people do say, hey, can we trust these currencies? They've let us down for many years. We've had our purchasing power eroded. Here's a digital currency where it doesn't erode. But you've then got to counter that. Well, what are the threats to Bitcoin? I mean, China essentially made it illegal in 2021. Price fell alongside the failure of some crypto exchanges. I mean, as you mentioned, I see the big risk is regulation, governments, and CBDCs. Because if you're the government and you're trying to put out a digital currency, and loads of them are, as is probably 2 years away here in New Zealand, based on the Reserve Bank website, you don't want your CBDC competing with other digital currencies.
Yeah, but how do you sell the idea that you don't have the freedom to access these digital currencies in a free country? That's kind of an authoritarian angle to that, isn't there?
Well, look, I thought the initial idea of CBDCs was a good one because it gave people options. And then I thought, hang on, Simon, you're not 4 years old. What happened during COVID? What did they do? I couldn't understand why they keep putting us into lockdowns and mandates. So there is that risk that an authoritarian government won't just put out a CBDC for the benefit of people. They'll use it as a means of control.
So with a cap of 21 million, do we know how many coins are out there now? I don't know. You might know.
It's always moving as they mine more. I think last I looked, memory's a bit rusty, about 17.8 million. That might have been a while ago.
They're heading that way.
Yeah, there's the halving coming soon, which reduces the incentive on new coins. So,
that's where new coins come in. Once that cap's hit, you've got to have a new coin.
Well, people are constantly mining and they get a reward for doing that, but the halving reduces that incentive there on that.
So at what point then do people need to start considering, I don't know, Bitcoin? I know it's not the same as gold, but this is kind of the same thinking, isn't it? And also, if Bitcoin appreciates, albeit in a kind of fluctuating way, too much, that's a disincentive to trade it, isn't it?
It's a disincentive to spend it if you believe Bitcoin's going to constantly appreciate. You're not going to want to run out and use it as a currency because it might be worth 10 grand more next week. Might also be worth 10 grand less.
Yeah. Yeah, what's more likely, though? all being even, no pressure from competing CBDCs, et cetera.
I don't have a crystal ball, Paul. What I will say is I was happy to buy it at $500. We don't buy it now because we can't see direct intrinsic value. We can't see a business producing revenue and returns, and we can't see property. I mean, as investors, we kind of got a group of companies that we watch pretty closely and we're married to those. Doesn't mean that if an exciting mistress comes along, our heads don't get turned, as in the case with Bitcoin. But look, when you look at that volatility and risk, I think you've got to take a very hard look at that. And I mean, I think a lot of Bitcoin investors, they have a shark mentality. They engage appetite rather than fully their brains.
When you're hungry.
Yeah, when you're hungry. You've really got to know what you're getting into and consider the risk that you're taking. And if you get a return based on high risk, well, that's probably well-deserved.
We had someone email the program last week who said that the ASB refused to make payments to some exchange he was buying Bitcoin from because they thought there was a high potential for fraud. It refused to, according to the email we got, refused to transfer the money for it. And he said at the end of the email, if he had bought what he was trying to buy back then. It'd be worth $4 million now.
Wow. So, does he have any recourse?
I don't think so. Long gone. So I guess you kick yourself a little if that happened. So what happens to a cryptocurrency if a CBDC comes in and blitzes everything else? Do they just suddenly lose their value?
Well, I think the way it starts out is, say New Zealand was, well, say the US was to introduce a digital currency. And I don't think Trump, if he gets in, wants to go down that path, or Vivek Ramaswamy said he said he doesn't want to.
Yeah.
But if you do have a situation where the US has got a federally backed digital currency based on the US dollar, and you've also got Bitcoin floating around and competing with it or other cryptocurrencies, there then raises the question, well, how do we license and regulate Bitcoin a bit more? And they can always point the finger and say, well, it's used in money laundering, it's used in crime. All I'm saying is, as we move into other government-backed digital currencies and they realize they've got competition, there could be a little bit more pressure on the downside.
Just want to ask you a few things about AI too, because I noticed Spark is calling people in and they're kind of talking about jobs being restructured using AI. And I guess there'll be more and more companies. We've been hearing about the first fully AI-controlled fast food restaurants. Mr. Flippy, so does that mean companies that start using AI like this are going to be better earners, pay more dividends, be a better investment? Is that what that will mean, do you think?
Yes, it's driving a lot of market excitement. The fourth industrial revolution, as they call it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's overhyped. I guess we'll see. But some analysts are saying, well, the efficiencies and additional margins AI could create could drive GDP growth around the world by 7%.
Really?
Considering the world normally grows at 2, 3, 4, yeah. 7% would be a new industrial revolution. And it's a pretty exciting time to be an investor.
Someone, though, still has to have a job to buy stuff to keep businesses operating and profitable. And we're talking a lot of middle-class, white-collar jobs, aren't we, here, potentially?
Yes, a lot of call center jobs, a lot of mid-level thinking jobs. They could well be replaced by AI. But I think, as I said on your last show, a new industry tends to create as many new opportunities, often more new opportunities than it destroys. But hey, I'm an optimist.
Yeah. A couple of other things that are here on the list. EVs. Do you think we've hit peak EV?
Oh, it's an interesting question. I see there was some news out about Hertz today. If I remember the figure correctly, they lost $245 million on trying to sell all the old EVs that renters didn't want. And it's amazing how smart people can sometimes make really dumb decisions.
Yeah.
Because when you look at a rental car business, well, you're normally traveling. You're not at home where you can charge the thing. So an EV may not be top of your mind. And of course, when you go to sell those Teslas, the buyers are saying, well, these were part of a rental fleet. The batteries have probably been fast charged and abused.
Right.
And that's the whole thing with EVs, is the depreciation. I mean, I love the whole idea of them, being able to charge at home, biking on a busy road, nice smooth cars going past you rather than trucks belching diesel. But my view is they've still got a way to go in the technology. Interesting, we actually had two clients call us a couple of weeks ago, and one said, oh, you're in General Motors and Toyota. You need to sell those stocks because they're not doing enough about EVs. And a few days later, really weird coincidence, another client says, oh, General Motors and Toyota, I want you to sell those stocks because they're doing too many EVs and I hate them. They're rubbish.
Oh, gee.
So,
okay.
In my business, the client's always right.
Yeah,
so you
of course.
Do what they ask. But I'll tell you what happened is both General Motors and Toyota don't do a lot of EVs, under 3%. Over the last 6 months, General Motors is up 20%. Toyota's up 30% over 6 months. Both pay a dividend of 1% or 2%. Tesla's down 35%.
Okay.
So the client who wanted to keep General Motors and Toyota, because they're not doing a lot of EVs, at this stage of the market cycle was probably on the money, because the market's saying, we're not sure about these guys yet. We're not sure customers beyond fleets and rental car companies are going to adopt them. Because the main thing customers are concerned about is the depreciation when it comes to sell your vehicle, and the buyer saying, well, what kind of battery life has it had? Do you fast charge it? Fast charge at McDonald's? You always do it slowly at home.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, I didn't realize there were all those sort of complications. So there's, well, for the rental car business, there's quite a bit in selling off cars that have coming out of the fleet. They expect to get some return for those. Is that part of the business model with that, turning over cars?
Yeah, and I think that particular rental car company missed that. I mean, as an investor, one thing I always keep in mind is just don't try and make smart decisions. Just don't try and make stupid ones.
Yeah. Good rule of thumb. And there's hydrogen on the way. I think Toyota have been showcasing recently a hydrogen internal combustion engine. And they look like they're starting to head towards some sort of maturity and are way more competitive ahead of EVs, because the hydrogen is less, the whole chain of getting it into a battery and into a car is a hell of a lot less complicated and intense. So, I mean, they may be gone soon, EVs.
Well, it's interesting. I listened to an interview with the chairman of Toyota, and he said, I think that EVs are going to peak at about 30% of new car sales. And I think the balance are going to be in things like hydrogen, hybrids, particularly hybrids.
Yeah.
He said, look, we sell across the world, and a billion people in this world that we sell to, they don't have electricity. We sell to them as well.
Good point, yeah. Good point.
Yeah. So I mean, unless they really improve the technology and the charge times and the range, I'm just struggling to see they'll repeat the sort of growth they've had in the past. Look, friends of mine have got Teslas, and a mate of mine said, oh, Simon, why don't you buy a Tesla? And I said, well, actually, I really like the car I've got. It's a 10-year-old Mercedes wagon. It's diesel. But a luxury for me is it goes 1,300 kilometres on a tank of diesel.
Yeah.
Without having to stop and charge it. And I go to cafes where there's no charger. And my mate says, yeah, but Simon, you're killing the dolphins. So I did a little bit more
research. There's a direct link.
Yeah, I did a little bit more research. I said, listen, mate, I've got 22 trees around my house, which covers my carbon for all my vehicular activities.
Yeah.
I'm covered.
Yeah. Well, the EV thing is, I think you have to be in a bigger picture sort of group, right? And that sort of thinking. It's like the example you just gave, you know, it's more than just getting around. It's like saving the dolphins. But, you know, how was he ever persuaded that, you know, there's a direct link or correlation? It's interesting how people think about these things.
Yeah, well, people get in love with brands like Tesla. I mean, don't get me wrong, they're lovely cars and he enjoys it. But I don't know if he goes as far as I do.
Well, I know they're beautiful machines, and a friend of mine's got a Tesla, and he showed me how fast it accelerates, and my eyeballs nearly came out the other side of my head, and all that. I get all that. But there's a sameness about them all. And when I see them on the road, and there's more and more on the road now, I see the same sort of people in them. You know, it's like a tribe, actually.
Well, interesting you say that, because I come across a group of people in that tribe. And now that the road user charges are going to hit from next month, and they've paid a lot of money, unfortunately, they didn't buy Teslas, which I do think are a little bit more beautiful. I think one of the SUVs they bought sort of looks a bit like you're driving a virtue signaling duck, in my opinion. But yeah, I did sense there was a little bit of buyer's remorse that, well, now we're paying this road user charge and we've got the range anxiety, and it's not quite what I expected.
Oh, range anxiety. Is that like a new psycho diagnosis? I'm afraid you've got range anxiety. That explains why you're behaving in this way.
Anxiety's a bad mixture.
You're always wondering if you're going to get there, even if you're walking.
Well, it's interesting the government's saying they're going to run out more charges. But if you look back at petrol and diesel engines, the government never had to put the service stations in. They just emerged organically.
Yeah, and I remember too when CNG LPG came in, I had a Holden, right? So it got converted. I've had an LPG and a CNG. That seemed to deploy really easily, really quickly, if I remember back in the day.
Did you have both? You had a CNG?
Yeah, well, one Holden, the Kingswood, was LPG, and then I had a Belmont after that that was CNG.
I have fond memories of that time. My dad had a Rover, and there was an incentive, I think, to convert to CNG. And he had this kind of little James Bond switch on the side of the dash.
Turbo.
Where
the flame come out the back.
Convert between your petrol or your CNG.
No, you could do. You could do. Yeah. The thing is, though, you take it from petrol to, well, particularly CNG, and that you could feel like you lost about, 20 horsepower.
That's right, especially going up a hill.
Yeah, you were the old Holden, the straight six. You know, those were the days. And finishing up on this, because we're going to be talking about this next week, and I've started to read this book. Any comment to make? Because it seems that people are kind of talking about this book, The Great Taking. Are things secure? Is it all just a bit of a house of cards out there?
No. I disagree with yep. David Webb on this. I don't know David what Webb, happened yep. to him. He was a former investment manager.
Yep.
Did Lifeline hang up on him? I don't know.
Could have.
Yeah, there are definitely aspects of truth in the book. I've reviewed it twice now because a client asked me to look at it last year, high net worth client. Then he put out a new edition, so I looked at that one too. Fear works very well, doesn't it?
Well, we know that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have a pretty vivid memory when I was about 7 or 8 years old. Harbour AMP show, went to a haunted house. And as you walk in, the floor's quite slippery, reach for the handrail, and it was electrified. Got a massive boot, like a kick in the ribs. And even though the couldn't do that now, of course, this was the 80s.
Oh, so that wasn't like an electrical fault. That was there to... As part of the...
Oh, yeah, it was part of the design. I mean, we were Taranaki kids, so we were used to electric fences.
Yeah, okay.
But this thing gave you a hell of a shock. And even though the rest of the attraction was just a, AMP show, haunted house, was pretty lame, we were dead scared because we'd had that shock to begin with.
Yeah, yeah.
So all the ghosts and ghouls had an entirely new meaning, and we were absolutely petrified by the time we came out of there. I think I'm still got PTS from it.
Yeah, you wouldn't get away with it. WorkSafe would have something to say about that now.
It's not the 80s now, but I think, look, and getting back to the Great Taking.
It's like having a defibrillator there, just in case. Sorry, yeah, I jumped in. Not the 80s now, no.
So the Great Taking, the whole concept is there's too much debt in the system, and that's going to blow, and we're going to lose everything. That's the first part of it.
Yeah.
Okay, so his golden age was the Kennedy days of the 60s. If you look at it now, household assets, didn't make a note of this, where are we? Household assets are 18 times what they were in the 60s.
18, all right, yeah.
But debt's only 5 times.
Okay, well, I can work that one out.
Assets have grown so much faster than debt. So generally, losing a bit of leverage is not really a big problem. There's not the kind of crisis here that's being made out to be.
Okay.
And well, the second...
Yeah. Good to hear. Yep, carry on.
And the second thing is this whole idea of dematerialized shares, which are held by nominees. Well, that was done for convenience. Because, I started with share certificates in the 90s and they were cumbersome things.
Right, yeah.
Really expensive to trade. I mean, a lot of investors in Australia and New Zealand are still trading on the registry, so their names are going direct on the share registry, so they're not affected. Mm. But look, if you're using a good, safe broker, which has got something like SIPC protection, which he barely goes into, the risk is not there. And, classic case in point quickly, as he mentions Lehman Brothers going bust and potentially those clients losing all their money because Lehman Brothers was the nominee for the shares. Well, from what I could see, that didn't happen at all. Those 80,000 odd clients were simply transferred to another brokerage through the process.
Okay, yep.
So look, there are grains of truth here, but I found more holes in it than a piece of Swiss cheese, to be honest.
Okay, interesting to get your take on it. Because we'll talk to Farzan next week and he'll tell us something completely different, I have a feeling. But, hey, that's what we're here to do, get every angle. So,
well, I look forward to what Farzan has to say. The more opinions and ideas you've got time for, the more you'll be able to digest and understand.
Simon, if people want to get in touch, what's the best way?
CS@wealthmorning.com will get to me.
Good to catch up with you again. Simon Angelo.
You too, Paul.
From Wealth Morning, and we'll talk again. And it just amazes me that something you could have bought, talking about Bitcoin here, only a few years ago, is now, it's gone from 500 to 73,000. I'm kicking myself. I'm kicking myself. Why didn't I do something? Why didn't I move on that?
Well, yeah, on the other side of that, it reached 64,000 in 2021, and then I think it dropped 75% to about 70,000.
Okay, well, there's that.
So be careful what you wish for, because there's some pretty arcane roller coasters out there.
Okay, we'll talk soon. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.